This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And Nishi Chawla is a poet as well as a writer of all genres. And we're going to find out about everything she does today. So Nishi, let's hear an opening poem.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Grace. Well, I'm going to read a poem titled Delusional Roots. We see them for a moment, those kernels, and then they disappear, teasing us with their material content, leaving us with a kind of dissatisfaction. Underground nodes of ourselves, cut off, exploded, multiplied. Then, having read about Asvatha, cosmic tree in divine self-regard, we may reverse direction, hanging on with supernatural force, live loose forever, otherwise alone, adrift. There is always a horizontal axis. The axis has always been there, holding up toward the blue sky and the brown earth, carefully diagrammed, sometimes pushed vertically up. The way the branches grow, neither cut down nor up, but fall naturally, footloose at the beginning, when those guardian angels go amok, absolutely. They have the gift of reminding you that the amplitude of life runs a downward course, hardly improved by sharing thoughts. Only memories blend, puzzled, gathered. They come into being, then pass out their vascular order in leaves, branches, veins. The ancient wisdom gets distributed, nor neglect their hidden secrets enshrined. We collect data of good and evil, trace their link with the underworld, land of the dead. We become their diverse voices, skins, race, untethered when the trunk separates. As in a game ordered by someone, shade or star, as in a fine oblivion of dates and names, we wait in the shadow of the tall grass for a trick of appearing, of disappearing. As in a card game, the king dominates, breaking all illusions of belonging. Though we try to break through the walls, push them aside, strive for clear, stable, and firm ground.
Nishi Chawla, that is beautiful. Her work is a philosophy and spirituality and the material world all in one. So Nishi was a professor at Delhi University for 20 years. Then she came to America and has been a professor for 20 years. That makes 40 years of teaching English.
Yes.
But what I want to honor right now is the anthologies that you produced, the global anthologies from Penguin Random House.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, they're beautiful. And Singing in the Dark is one of them. And what is the other?
Greening the Earth.
Greening the Earth. Tell us what content is in each anthology, because they each have an ideal purpose.
Well, Grace, yes, I have co-edited with a well-known Indian poet, Sachidanandan, K. Sachidanandan, Dr. K. Sachidanandan, Singing in the Dark and Greening the Earth. They were published by Penguin Random House in 2020 and 2023. And that include over 100 poetic voices from across the globe, reflecting on the nature of a changed world order within the throes of the pandemic and a present environmental crisis. Greening the Earth is a global anthology of poems on the impact of human intervention on our environment and on nature. The book carries poems from across the world, not by Indian poets or only by American poets, but you know, poems from across the world, you know, by eminent and contemporary poets who are ecologically sensitive concerning this revival of nature as a prerequisite to the survival of the human species.
Right. So greening the earth was really about ecology and saving the planet. And then the other book was really about the pandemic, wasn't it?
Yes.
Singing in the Dark. So you took two huge concepts and found poets who wrote about this. How did you ever organize these hundreds of poets from all over the world? How did you do that?
Well, it was an overwhelming response. Fortunately for my co-editor, K. Sachidanandan, who knew many more poets as the, you know, director of a well-known festival, Kerala Literary Festival, and that's where I got invited by him to read my poetry just before the pandemic. I got to know him. And because he's so well known and he has connections and networks across the globe, I know more Indian poets and American poets, a lot more American poets by now in these past 5 years. So, you know, this certainly helped. We did win, and, you know, getting it published, it's just kind of, you know, is also a mammoth task by itself.
Yes, I do know. Ordering the poems, bios for the poems, contacting the poets. We thank you for this, and we thank you for being a poet, and we'd love to hear another poem.
Thank you. I'm going to read a poem titled Of Dust and Dread. They belong to the same category, Sensulato. For bewitched humanity, hunkered down by faith that ought to breed an interest in the lost gold of soul, fire from its walls. History counts its pages in tarnished ochre, the pillars of Hindu temples raised, etched with holy inscriptions. They lie inside awakened mosques for centuries, plummeting beyond the fading eyes of falling trees, to discover new empires, waken to new churches of domes and spires that still make the call to prayer, sober blue minarets that echo with hallowed spaces. Draw comfort from the memory of idols placed inside, then withdrawn. Sink in heaps of faith of temples squashed, then mosques that bequeath long shadows of churches melting into mosques, domes of desire, desperate prayers, and niche womb chambers, idols lost, replaced. Fountains of ritual cleansing do not erase backlash. The tomb and the palace lie in ruins, or collect them in dusty corners of our fears, subtle, monotheistic, roofed over in gorgeous geometric patterns, hexagons of intensity, open spaces of regret, abandoned by faith, circular designs of dust and dread. The brittle bones lie in carvings, ornately reignited in cemeteries, lurching, rock-cut cave shrines, give shrill voice nor credence, where the hushed blade twists akin to war, carvings sculptured, stained glass windows. They know the depths of each pillars, tell stories about their towering shrines, yet coax a healing and a deep hurt treacherous. Thank you.
Nishi Chavla, you write of what stays and what cannot stay. Your poems are all about what is preserved, what is lost, and about motion. Very important. If we read each line slowly, we will get a very profound understanding of your work. People like to know a little bit about how you write a poem. And I was wondering if one, you sit down at the same place every day, and two, if you wait to be inspired, or is it inspiration or perspiration? And how you enter a poem, is it from a feeling? Give us just a minute of your process. How do you make a poem?
Well, you know, my writing process is like an implosion within me. I wrap my
mind around an idea that bursts within me and then sometimes surprises me to my own inner self. You know, sometimes I'm sitting in a plane. I remember writing one of my plays that has been staged a couple of times, you know. So it kind of, and in fact, at this moment today itself, there's an off-Broadway production of that play in New York City. So I'm very honored for that. So it's like, you know, it bursts within me. And no, I don't kind of, you know, write in the same spot. I do have my own office, of course, in my house, but I kind of, you know, I try to vary, places where I sit. I don't often, you know, going to my writing process, I don't often see clearly where I should go with, you know, that implosion, that inflagration, sort of, so to say, within me. And when the way forward, so to say, seems nebulous, there are ideas that creep around me from behind me, almost like, you know, by stealth, they crowd my other thoughts out, so to say. And sometimes the outburst seems very condensed. It's waiting, so to say, to be fleshed out. And, you know, so it's like, I'm thinking about, should I push my, you know, my vision, my message is important to me. But what is also more important to me is, should there be no message? Should I push my ideas, my vision down the throats of my audience, my listeners, my readers? These are important concerns to me. And one more important concern is solitude. I know solitude and creativity have often been twinned together. And we do know that solitude enhances artistic receptivity in a way that's kind of very challenging, and it can also be very painful. You know, like you get thrown back upon yourself when you're sitting there alone and working. So process is central to, you know, creativity. And for me, writing is more a process, so to say, is less a thinking process than it is a channeling from an unknown region, a kind of, you know, unknown or even a higher place that often bypasses the logical mind, the rational mind.
I believe you with all my heart. I think artists do channel. I think the light you bring in has a lot to do with the information. So give us a sample of another poem now that we know how it implodes, Nishi Chawla.
Thank you. I read this poem, Discolored. It's going to be published in a collection of poems that a Massachusetts-based publisher is publishing, my seventh collection of poetry called Random Circles of Belief. It's on race and religion. And it's also been published in the Yearbook of Indian Poets in English. I've just kind of, you know, got that. But I'm very excited that it has been accepted by Human Error Publishing. In fact, I had three publishers, American publishers, were willing to publish my new collection of poems, Random Circles of Belief. And this poem is titled Discolored. Dis with a hyphen, Discolored. Yesterday afternoon, the sun spoke to me slowly, lazily, cheekily, carefully checking me for after effects with its flashbulb style scans. I looked back at the glowing red, befuddled. My captive soul knew a riptide for its message. Why would I wear safety eyewear? For we are all birds in flight, loosened upon a fissured planet, branded by the color of our skin tone and type. I cling to my roots that turns into a new answer, cut loose, my fate blooming in brown earth, my pain turns into a no response, like a black slash of lightning, somber messenger of fate. I am my own little garden, content to be raking my kind of grass, and the plants do not question. Adrift in my shadow, nor off color, or of which color, those dreadful clocks of colorless seasons sealed. I hate the peace of coloring and its weird lies, endured beyond the black like me poppings. I scream with pain, squeak through buckets of water, a voyager on green mountains, sun blocked. Variety is just a potholed causeway, the orange man noted, speculating about this motley ring, a passage full of fools. And history is the present tense of skins, tags, sticking out, flying in mute shades, as in a void, with a white pennant sticking, diaphanously strutting, thundering cheap rhetoric about the beauty of probabilities. Skin tones facilitate the suspension of logic. Different perspectives provoke productivity, and yet one stays strictly slotted in grooves. Comfort itself bears artful shapes of sameness. Between the thudding sound of cultures, a strange line of beliefs persist, breed normative for clothes between soft-strung, clinging values nurtured by centuries of ethnic types. Thank you.
Nishi, seven books of poetry, and I'm fascinated with how you got into filmmaking. How many films? You have four films now that are, I think, three are feature length, right?
Four are feature. All four are
feature length. And a couple are on Amazon.
Yes.
On
three
Prime.
Are. Yes.
And so how did this ever, at what moment did you say, I need to include the visual with the verbiage? At what point did you want to put your ideas into pictures?
You know, it does seem inconceivable at first sight, of course, you know, that...
It's impossible!
That a long-standing academician would write, direct, and produce four feature films, you know, and these are art house movies, and they're all based on my plays. So I have published about nine plays and nine feature-length plays and one short play also, so 10 plays in all. And... Somehow I did adapt my first play that was on interracial love.
I saw that.
Thank you.
You sent me the film of one of your plays.
Yes, Mixed Up. That's still streaming on Amazon Prime. That's about the hostility of a white American professor's white wife to her two daughters' boyfriends, one a Hindu doctor and the other a Muslim. I had to deliberately simplify, so to say, the plot. And of course, the hostility and interracial tensions. And the film is set, the first half of the film is set in the 1970s. And the second half, of course, the consequences of the daughter's choices. And then I wrote a film, a play. This is also, the second one is also was based off a play called The Strange Case of Normalcy, which is about how, you know, all of us normal, smart, intelligent people like to believe, you know, and we like to pigeonhole ourselves within the realm of normalcy. But, you know, it's about five young men who graduate from an Ivy League college. And, you know, it's like, you know, the blurred terrain, so to say, between normalcy and what falls out and what society likes to somehow label as bipolar, as schizophrenic, as suicidal, as, you know, but what about us normal people and our loneliness, our suicidal thoughts, our alienation, our forms of abnormality, so to say, and which the five young men evince, project bit by bit as they break down. That was my. So this was my second film. And my films are very non-linear. My plays are very non-linear. The third film was about, it's that one is based on a novel I had written in 2000. And that was titled A Human Silicon Chip. It was about the boom and the bust of the Silicon Valley era. And how, you know, technology, of course, we like to have smart TVs, smartphones, smart everything in our homes. But technology has also led to a huge concentration of wealth. And also, you know, the social inequities have, so to say, increased. And it has also resulted in, so to say, you know, choices people who take, it's about sibling rivalry between a brother who was academically smarter, but chose to to kind of pursue liberal arts, becomes a liberal arts professor, versus his younger brother, who chooses computer science and makes his pot of gold before he turns 30. So that was my third play titled Tech News. I retitled it as Tech News. That's also streaming on Prime. And my fourth feature film is titled The Peace Activists, and it places Martin Luther King and a black guy, a brown guy, and a white guy. The white guy is Henry David Thoreau, whose short essay, Civil Disobedience, inspired Gandhi. And then Gandhi, of course, subsequently inspired Martin Luther King. So the film places them, MLK and Gandhi, within the crucible of a dramatic plot that will bring out their kind of, you know, remarkable similarities in the cause of peace and nonviolence, so to say, and in their engagement with civil disobedience as a tool and as a kind of methodology. So, it's all right to research and to bring together there and to know a little about there. And of course, I research extensively on MLK and on Gandhi and Henry David Thoreau. But to kind of, you know, tease out a fictional plot out of their interactions was the more challenging part. And, it has been... It's now with a distributor who promises to put it on Prime again. And he's also planning to take it to Indian television.
Oh, I am so impressed. Here is what I believe about you. You would love to change the world. And you work with huge ideas. Your work comes from the wish for humanity to remain as human as possible. Everything you do, whether it's ecology, racism, or mental acuity, or civil rights, justice, you start with an ideal. And I think it burns in you, Nishi, until it takes form. That's the way I feel about you. Everything you do is based on a higher cause. None of it is just, and then you take characters to represent different ideas of the argument. Then you put those characters up against each other to flesh out their beliefs. So I'm so impressed and proud of the work you've done. You must never, never sleep.
You're very insightful, Grace. Thank you so much. I do sleep a lot, in fact.
Let's hear a poem.
Let's hear a poem. 8 to 10 hours sometimes when I burn out, when you kind of, expend so much mental energy, you tend to sleep a lot.
Please don't burn out. Let us have a poem from Nishi Chawla.
Thank you. I'll try to read a different poem now and then come back to, I'll read a poem, Early Morning Companions. This is also being published in Random Circles of Belief. Early Morning Companions. I think of snakes coiled, shadows merge, a lone bird repeats a love song, rolls her tongue in the blinding cold, sinks into the pit of my dervish desires to dance around. My groans sparkle with my seeded desires. The snake puts on a nightfall skin. I build a fire around my own ownness. Beyond myself, I find myself rolling, slipping down a cliff. Then I long for my mother. I assume she is still with me, trying to carve meanings, muted by time, muted by her departure, angels' mutilated wings, sudden. She helps me rise, strips me of my colored truths that die by the hour. She forgives me in words that escape a language, naked, new, like sleeping again in her wet womb. She brings no companions, no witnesses in the dragging light of dervishes. Only morning catches the blind spot of light, spread fragments, then fold them carefully like lingering aches. break the spell. She convulses into the shadows, gone through the gaps of dead. I sink into a satisfaction that frames and flutters, gives me leave to be myself again, coiled like a snake in honey, stitching at dark seams, hung through the wind's breath, grinding toward the deep ground, dig out the seeds like dying grasses. They too wail.
Nishi, what did your mother give you? What do you think she did for you? What was she to you? Was she affectionate?
Yes, extremely. All my values, my sense of my high sense of morality, my sense of social responsibility. And we were born Hindus in India, and I'm still a practicing Hindu, if you may call it that way. But she would always tell me that the greatest religion is not to hurt anyone. And we grew up in an India about 60 years ago, which was, I'm 66 now. We grew up in an India that did not, that was less polarized, and we were not somehow, kind of aware of religious differences. Racial differences, of course, one does kind of, confront them most starkly in a country like the United States when I got transplanted here. But those religious differences, even amongst Christians, and I studied in convent schools, reading the scriptures or reading, I know my Bible also very well. And, there was no difference between Hindus or Muslims, so to say. So, that was something that she gave me. And
different cultures are different in relation to their mothers. In some cultures, children love their mothers, but their mothers never touch them, never kiss them, never hug them, but they feel their love. Now, in America, we're all kinds of ways because we're all from different nationalities. But yes. I was just wondering, because you seem to have a huge wish to make everyone aware of compassion. Compassion seems to be your main thrust in life. So I thought there must be something between you two that was extremely special. And apparently there was. Was she a strict mother?
Yes, in some ways she was a disciplinarian, and I have somehow imbibed and also taken her ideas of discipline. And I have also in many ways raised my two sons. My husband and I have been married for over 40 years. So, raised them in a disciplined manner, which I somehow find it a little disruptive in a modern world, be it, India or the United States or any part of the world. So yes, she was a disciplinarian, but then she did give me, those liberal ideas, so to say, the idea to expand oneself, to think about others, to be inclusive, so to say, to enhance our understanding of ourselves, through our shared experiences, our reflections, so to say, and that kind of cultural.
That's progressive. She was pretty progressive.
I think so, yes.
Was she typical? I think she was unusual.
No, a lot of Indian mothers can
be.
Oh,
really? Uh-huh. Well, this is so good. Let's have another.
I was blessed to have her as a mother.
You were blessed to have her, and I know she's listening. So let's have another poem.
Oh, well, thank you. This will be, as I promised, this will be a different poem. If only there were red peacocks. If only there were red peacocks, or the late afternoon mating call of a young husband bewitched, a sleeping beauty bathed in blue. He could even think of leaving her, swamped by the blue illuminating his own inner voice, swirl, swish, in slow tandem, leave her kneeling. If only there were red peacocks and not this maniacal din when she prepared to dress in red, moaning the coal fire conversations at night. He would press his palms under the sticky, sad buttocks sticking from under the blue table that he saw turning red in the final gleaming hour. Enraged, she stares out into our transitioned space, forebodes a blue peacock instead of a red one. Cajoled into leaving, she feels he has crystallized into a newborn. The spines of everything dwindling, red rotting, sprouting the mold of stubborn forgiveness, nailed to the fence where the peacocks align their cloacas iridescent, riveted as if the epiphany tracks pale recumbent blues. They contest the bubbling birth of more red and blue, abjured certainty, the angles and edges of life.
Nishi, magic realism and a little surrealism. So you do a bit of everything. You don't mind your nighttime mind. You honor your nighttime mind. Before we have a final poem, I want to hear about the play that is opening this month in New York off Broadway. What's it about? Is that the Gandhi play?
Yes, Kasturba versus Gandhi. The world knows Mahatma Gandhi. You know, everyone has heard about Mahatma Gandhi and his mission of peace and nonviolence. Though the world has not learned anything from, you know, what Gandhi and subsequently MLK did, lost their lives for that cause of peace.
I agree with that.
Yes, but for, you know, my play, for the purposes of my play, which I wrote about 10 or 12 years ago, it has been staged very often by a well-known theater director in New Delhi. Her name is Shilpi Marwaha, and she takes it to Delhi University colleges also. It has been staged 4 times in the United States, in Chicago, in Maryland, by a community theater also here. But, you know, now it's being staged in an off-Broadway productions. There are 12 shows, so to say. The focus of my play, the theme of my play is Kasturba, who is not as well known to the world. The world does not know that Gandhi got his ideas, so to say, of, you know, Satyagraha from his wife, who was uneducated. He did not know. So the world has always perceived or somehow thought that, you know, someone who lived 200 years ago, 200 plus years ago, in a small village in Gujarat, in the western coast of India, how could she be so progressive and have such, you know, different ideas, modern, if you may.
Say her name again.
Kasturba. Kastur. Ba is, you know, ba is like an older woman is called, I'm told, in Gujarat. Ba is the grandmom. So, you know, subsequently when
Kasturba, okay.
Kasturba, K, like K. Yeah. The play is titled Gandhi versus Kasturba. And it's about, the play is just a series of battles, arguments between the two. So I'm, of course, disrupting people's assumptions that Kasturba was one of those doormat kind of Indian women, or very submissive, or, you know, so it's like, you know, so I'm definitely breaking that assumption by just showing 5 or 6, or maybe more, say 10 scenes of fights or arguments between the two of them. It's very interesting that Gandhi, you know, a lot of people don't know. My research showed me how he was somehow fascinated with ideas, you know, of white philosophers, a lot of European philosophers, and he would implement them. He would enforce them on his children, on his 4 sons, or on his wife. And, you know, he also started experimenting, so to say. His book, My Experiments with Truth, is well known. But Gandhi also started, you know, that's something called self-denial or abnegation from, which is what can be enforced chastity upon Gandhi. So in one scene, which is a little kind of, you know, a little, I was radical, it may seem, you know, coming from an Indian playwright, where she questions, she says, what about my wishes? What about my desires? You know, you go around inflicting your desires, your wishes, whatever you read, you spout different philosophies every second year, but, you know, think about me as a woman also. And that's how the play ends.
You are casting a new light.
Thank you. Yes, Kasturba, just Kasturba, or her life. I believe there are short films, there are short plays, but this is basically between the two.
So I never heard of her. I've never heard of her. So there you have made a contribution right there. And now, as a final contribution, A poem, a last poem, a final poem, not forever, just for this program.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I will read Fairy Tale City with No Color. I was planning on reading something else, but I'll read Fairy Tale City with No Color. The title, of course, is self-explanatory. When a colorless time comes a-running, the mind within my colored soul snapped, shuddering. A house full of gorgeous memories ran, opened up, escaped into the dungeon of virgin, color-free words that slipped from me in visceral wounds, merging into self-inflicted collages, colored hate. As the shelled sun and the hissing moon became one, as the morning melted with the sky, shed a thickened smoke, wore a spring-like wail, hung in deafening depths, table swift, digitized manner. Until a no-color engine reached the weirdmost recesses of impending, restless night, snoring aloud its troubles, doomed in many colors. We blend into the colors of our mother's unused wails, wails numb as the footsteps that carry alone a weighted gaze, amber and yellow accusations, like a bounty of intimate sorrows staying adrift in a strange relationship with the colors of our souls, our past creeping into our skins with no use value, a sense of buried alleyways blurred by us, darkened, deliberately denying, let loose by a superfluous sense of control, trauma of our wombs placed in the time bombs of colorless grief, choked by freezing violence that blooms on the heads of trees, drifting away, trapped in mystic missing tones, chafing beyond the hope of another failure, growling, prowling, changing ownership, unpossessed by smiling faces that alter their customs and cultures. Migrant passages leave no trace of eternity, no harbors, nor any open seas. Only faces dreaming of a fairy tale city with no color.
The voice of Nishi Chawla, migrant passages facing dreaming of a city without any color. That is paraphrasing her last line, but very powerful ideas cloaked in very beautiful language. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, by the Anne Arundel Arts Council, Rivada Foundation, and friends of the program, Natalie Canavore, Avide Shoshani, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.